Welcome to the Underground, the Steel City Underground, the black and gold standard for Pittsburgh Steelers coverage. Now, here are your hosts, Brian E. Roach and Zach Meckler.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Steel City Underground podcast. My name is Brian Roach, the host who, as you know, doesn't like toast and refuses to eat bread of any kind at the moment. Today, we have what may be a first for us. We are actually really fully entering into the whole draft season mentality, and we're going to look at what has happened at the NFL Combine. And to help us do that, one of our frequent guests on the podcast, you know him as the professor of football, Mr. Zach Meckler, has joined us. Zach, how you doing this morning?
Alive. I'm well. There's draft season, so it just adds a little bit of fuel to the fire. So I'm living life right now.
All right. And then joining the professor of football, someone who as of yet does not have a spiffy nickname, and we'll have to try and come up with him one for him. But one of the stalkers of the SEU backhauls, one of our draft guys, making his, I think, first appearance on the podcast, Derek Overly. Derek, how are you today?
I'm doing good. It is my first time on the podcast, and I don't know how I like being called a stalker very much, but...
Stalking the halls. We all stalk the back rooms. We are all stalkers in the back rooms of SCU. not that you're particularly stalking any one individual. You just meander around the halls. That's all.
Meander.
You're a meanderer. So, you know, the combine is always big news. You know, it's the first, the first real, I guess, point of entry for players who are going to be in the upcoming draft to make another, impression, beyond, you know, whatever their season was in. And, there's all the lovely events that occur, you know, all the different drills that occur, and are we midway? Because we're recording this on Saturday. The schedule has been sort of flip-flop. It's Thursday, Friday, so it's Saturday and Sunday still to go, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, we may do a second follow-up on this podcast after it's all said and done, but we wanted to kind of deep dive into it as best we can, and give folks out there a sense of hey, what's the point of this whole thing, and who has made some strides, you know, who's helped make a name for themselves based on this. So, you know, what I want to start with is there's a variety of drills that occur at the combine. Everybody knows, of course, the 40-yard dash. Woohoo! We all know 40-yard dash, pretty straightforward. Measure speed, measures explosiveness. You run fast. Yay. You've got bench press. You've got vertical. You've got broad jump. And then there's these other drills, the three cone, the 20, what is it actually called? The 20-yard shuttle and the 60-yard shuttle. So to help educate everybody, let's understand what is important about the three cone drill. What is the three cone drill, and why does anybody care about guys running around cones? And we'll start with the professor, because, you know, why not? He loves to pontificate.
So the three cone drill is a drill that really is applicable to most positions on the field. Typically, the cones are in three spots in an L shape, 5 yards apart, kind of beating your way through them. And the entire point of that drill is to kind of show your ability to change direction at a fast rate of speed. Which obviously is applicable for any position, running back, receiver, edge, safety. You want to be able to see you kind of go and dip that corner and be able to go at a high rate of speed around the edge, in and out of cuts if you're an offensive lineman trying to block and move on a dime, those types of things. So you really want to be able to show that at a high rate. Players that we've seen not do that well are guys like Jarvis Jones, which has been applicable then to seeing how they've kind of plummeted as football players. And then you see guys like T.J. Watt, who did well at the drill, and we've seen what kind of productivity he's had off the edge, being able to really come and explode off the edge. So it's been not a, an end-all, be-all drill, but a lot of the times you can see some indication of what type of player it's going to be when it comes to just quick rate of change of speed in the next level.
And, Derek, you got anything to add to that? Any other things you look at when you, when you're watching a player run a three-cone drill?
Like Zach said, it's not necessarily the end-all, be-all. We've seen players have four ones that have been successful. Just last year, DK Metcalf comes to mind. He got knocked a lot for his three-cone drill. Still came out and had a good rookie season. But it lends more towards the agility aspect of the game, not just running in a straight line, like the four-yard dash.
Gotcha. All right, so when... when a if you're a fan and you're watching the combine now for the first time, or you know, maybe because now that it's been you know, changed so that a lot of these drills are running later in the day, not not in the early morning afternoon, but rather in the evenings, and more fans now get an opportunity to come home from work, sit down, and actually watch what's going on. What should they look for specifically when watching a three-cone drill for somebody, and you know, how it runs? Because, you know, a lot of fans will watch and go, okay, yeah, he ran fast. But are there intricacies of that drill that they should be looking at?
Yeah, you really want to stay tight when you're going around the cone. A lot of times you'll see players get loose because they're kind of looping around. You're weaving your way through. So it's not exactly like you're just going around the outside. So a lot of time, what I'm looking for is a guy that's going to be able to stay low in and out of those cuts as they're looping around there, seeing a lot of really quick feet, keeping tight to the cone and not really looping yourself out around. You want to be as tight as you possibly can when you're weaving through the cones, and that kind of shows your ability to move on a pin and not have to worry about trying to, you know, get loose in and out your brakes. If you do that typically with the quick feet, you're going to see guys have a higher level of success, but the ones that are not as confident in their ability to do that, like DK Metcalf was last year, which obviously wasn't indicative of his performance as he was a standout rookie, it's really going to show in their ability to not really go around the cones in a quick manner. You want to be able to see them go around the cone and then burst out as quickly as they can, like being shot out of a cannon. Those short area explosive traits are what you kind of look for a lot of football players, because those are applicable at really any position you play, sans maybe kicker. You know, so you're going to be able to have the opportunity to see these guys go and do that. And as long as you're staying low, having a bunch of quick feet, and staying tight to the cones, you're going to typically see some level of success from these players.
All right, Derek, anything additional from you?
No, Zach pretty much hit the nail on the head there. Just keep it tight, keep it smooth, and try not to knock the cones over, please.
All right, so then there's two shuttles, a 20 and a 60, and – Derek, we'll give you the first shot at these. When you're talking about the 20-yard or the 60-yard shuttle, what are those drills designed to show the scouts and the teams about a player?
Excuse me one second. I have to cough. So you have the 20-yard shuttle and the 60-yard shuttle. The 20-yard shuttle, obviously being the short shuttle, you'll hear it referred to that quite often when you're watching the combine. It's basically just evaluating the quickness of the change of direction by the players. So they're running back, and you start with the shuttle, and you run one direction, stop, and then run back the other direction. It's basically how fast you can stop, change direction from a full sprint. Is that correct, Zach?
Yeah, you're looking at a lot of the lateral quickness there, because you want to be able to go, and it's a really short area because you're starting at the center point, then you're going 5 yards to the right, 10 yards back, so you're going 5 past the original and 5 through the middle there. So it's all about the short area lateral explosion you want to see there from these guys.
And then the 60-yard shuttle just extends that out further, and you get more of a full sprint that you're stopping from.
Yeah, it's more about the anaerobic aspect of it all.
Gotcha. Okay. So hopefully, you know, because there's a slew of players who haven't run those drills, they'll you know, some position groups that are going to come up over the next couple of days. Some people have run them. You know, a lot of the wideouts have run stuff. Tight ends have run some stuff. I don't think anybody's run 60 yet. You know, that gives folks, I think, an idea of what to look for. Now, I was watching, there's an interview on the Steelers YouTube channel with Brandon Hunt. Brandon Hunt is the scouting coordinator for the Steelers. And one of the questions that Missy Matthews, who, Missy Matthews, if you ever listen to this, you still owe me a bobblehead, damn it. But one of the issues or the things that that Missy asked him was, what's the most overrated drill in the combine? And his answer is probably, to me, is not surprising, and it probably isn't surprising to you guys, but it may be surprising to more casual watchers, which is, it's the 40. And the reason is because, yes, while it shows straight line speed and everybody gets very excited about it, and it, you know, players get shoe contracts, the fastest one gets a shoe, all that stuff, is that it does not really necessarily, and Zach, this is leading me into your Zach Moss backroom comments here. It does not necessarily indicate the speed level of a play that a player performs at. You know, being able to do cut a fast 40 is good. They want to see what your top line speed may be, but it doesn't necessarily indicate your speed of play. Would you guys agree with that comment, or do you think there is a different drill that is, you know, more or less overrated for what the attention it gets?
I think the 40-yard dash of all the drills at the combine is probably the most overrated. I've been saying that for a while now because I it's a fun event to watch. Don't get me wrong. I love seeing guys like, you know, Henry Ruggs, or even thinking back to like John Ross, where they're running, you know, low 4.2s. It's just a fun thing to watch. Or when you see a guy like Becton from Louisville running a 5.11 at 364 pounds. It's just a cool thing to see. But I'm not putting a whole lot of investment in there because there's very few times on a football field we're going to be able to uninterrupted run 40 yards. No one's touching you like it's a track meet. And that, in my mind, there's so much more of a lateral aspect to football when you're digging and dunking left and right that are making guys miss. If a guy has a slow 40 time but a fantastic three cone or a fantastic vert or broad jump, I'm going to take that any day of the week because you see guys like Zach Moss, for example, you know, at random, an abysmal 3.65 or 4.65. You're in a 3.65. We won't be having this conversation. A 4.65. you know, where he goes and he looked encumbered by something, you find out he had a little tweaked hamstring. But even if that was the case and he didn't really have that issue, you turn on the tape, you see him burning guys down the field that are defensive backs and things like that. And that's not going to be the case if you're running almost a 4.7. So I think there's a lot more to play speed. I mean, look at a guy like Deontay Johnson, for example. He ran a 4.57 last year. Now, I don't think anybody in the right mind is going to sit there and say that he's not a fast football player. We saw him how many times beat guys over the top. That one punt return again against the Cardinals was just straight athleticism. Antonio Brown, another 4.5 guy. Juju was a 4.5 guy. And, you know, Juju has two of the longest touchdown catches in Steelers history. So, I mean, I think the 40-yard dash is such an over-convoluted event. I think people, especially draft Twitter, puts way too much stock in them. I think game time speed and game tape speed are what matter more in the 40-yard dash. I think it's just a fun thing to watch because watching somebody run very fast in a straight line is entertaining to us for whatever reason. I think that's about the extent of it.
Derek, what about you?
I think the 40-yard dash is fun for fans and players alike. I mean, Henry Ruggs this year came in gunning to break the record in the 40-yard dash. It's a competitive nature. But as it lends to football, I mean, Bruce Arians said, I think it was Bruce Arians that said this year, you could run a 4.3 at the 40-yard dash, but your game tape says you're 4.6. Or you could run a 4.6, but your game tape says you're 4.3. Football in shorts, man.
Tape doesn't lie. The tape doesn't lie. Right?
Correct.
All right. So if that's the most overrated of the drills, what to you guys, and Derek, we'll start with you this time. What to you guys is the most important drill? That what's the most important aspect of the combine to you guys?
I really put a lot of stock in two main ones. I like the three-cone drill. I like seeing the change of direction. I put a little bit more stock into the bench press than most do as well because I like to see some sort of functional strength from the players. I don't want an offensive lineman that's going to go out and put up 6-7 reps, you know?
I mean, I agree with that because, I mean, whenever Ronnie Stanley did, like, he had, like, a very low number, and I thought it was very indicative of what his play strength was on tape. And obviously I ended up being wrong because of the fact he ended up being such a fantastic lineman for the Ravens, but I dinged his stock a lot, and from that point on, I'm like, I'm not going to pay attention to that as much as I did. But I do get your point about wanting to not have a lot of low-rep guys, and you see a punter go and put up 25, and it makes you really kind of look yourself in the mirror and wonder what you're doing.
Exactly. On the converse, on the other side, though, it's not the end-all, be-all again, because Stephen Pea, if I'm saying that right, 10 years ago, put up over 40-some reps on the bench and did nothing, so.
Zach, what about you?
I put a lot of stock in the vertical jump and the broad jump. I think both of those, especially for certain positions, I mean, their entire purpose, I think a lot of people look at the vertical jump as just saying, well, that guy can jump really high. But there's more to it than that. That entire test is to kind of show lower body explosion. So when you're seeing these guys that have these powerful lower bodies that are jumping 40 inches, you know, that's a huge aspect of not just they can jump really high. That's all lower body explosion. Same thing with the broad jump. You know, those are both trying to quantify how explosive you are from a standing position where you don't have a running start or anything. You're just going right here and we're just jumping as far or as high as we possibly can. And you see a lot of these guys that may not test very well in the 40-yard dash, but they're putting up these ridiculous numbers in the vertical and in the broad jump. And you're seeing explosive players. And a lot of the times, the guys that test well in those areas, it also shows up on the tape when they're having this incredible burst or when they're coming off the line as a lineman and they're just completely ramming people back. You know, that I think in my mind, football's an explosive sport. I love having explosive players on my team. I think guys that can do well in either one of those tests are going to be the guys that kind of fit that mold, and you should see some correlation between what their vertical jump is and how explosive they are on the football field.
All right, and it will be no surprise, I think, to any of you, because this is an aspect of the combine that the fan or the viewer isn't going to really get an opportunity to judge. But Brandon Hunt said to him the most important thing is the interviews, which makes sense. I think a lot of decisions get made based on interviews. We've all heard the different kind of interview stories that can or can't occur and the crazy questions that occur. But that psychological analysis, so to speak, of the players, I think for teams is heavily weighted because as he described it, what they look at the combine as is this is a chance for them to really get in front of the players with their hair still down, so to speak. In other words, they haven't had enough time from the end of the season until now for their agents to polish them, for the guys to get used to saying only what they think teams want to hear. And it's looser. The interview process is a little looser from the standpoint of the players may let some stuff out that is more, I don't want to say intimate, but more descriptive of who they are as people, and you get less of that as they become more polished in their interview process. I thought that was an interesting comment because to me, a lot of times, you know, we've watched interviews with these guys in college. They've already started that process, right? As they've come up, where they know here's the talking points I have. This is the kind of stuff I got to say, and I got to get away from everything else because I don't want to become a lightning rod for something. But I thought it was interesting that he said that about this interview process. And would you guys have thought that would be the case, or would you have assumed that most of these guys coming in would have been already on their P's and Q's, so to speak?
Yeah, I think the interviews and whatnot are kind of the thing that a lot of people, and I don't mean to continue to bash Draft Twitter, but you know, Draft Twitter doesn't always take those things into consideration. I think those are more indicative because I think the athletic testing that goes on at the combine, you know, kind of helps paint a picture for some of the players and kind of gets you the full aspect of who they are. But at the end of the day, you know, that you ask a lot of those NFL alumni, they're all saying this is the biggest job interview on the planet.
Yep.
And you're going through there, and at the end of the day, it's fine and great if you can play football really well. But if you're a head case or you're going to be a headache for a team, you know, they're not going to take you. You know, you hear stories all the time of these dudes that are top-ranked prospects. They sit down in the interview and they come off as egotistical. They come off as just gaudy and unintelligent or not team players or whatever. And a lot of the time, these teams aren't going to be attracted to that because if we're going to invest a draft pick in you and money in you and one day have to invest some decent money in you and you're going to be a head case like that, we're not going to want you no matter how talented you are in football. And I think that's the thing that gets overlooked at this. And we wonder why guys rise and fall on boards. You know, what was it, Kevin Colbert that said, really, at this point in the year, the draft boards are more set than the fans realize they are. You know, there's guys that will move a little bit here and there, especially when you see guys running really well at the combine or doing well in the interviews. They may rise up a little bit whenever teams first have their exposure to them. But at the end of the day, the interview aspect is what's important about a lot of these things. And, I agree with Brandon Hunt in the sense that I think that might carry more weight than the skills do. Because, again, if I can't work with you as a human, as a man, and I'm going to have to commit to you for 4 years or cut you and then realize I just wasted a draft pick, that's huge. And teams don't want to do that because they also have to rely on keeping their jobs and putting on a winning product on the field. I think really they have that stuff in order ahead of time. They kind of have guys that they know, and these scouts and the coaches and whatnot, they talk to these guys, all as coaches throughout the course of the year. They get some exposure to them in a very limited fashion, during the regular season when they're going and viewing games. But this is really their first chance to sit down and ask these dumb questions. And you hear the goofy questions that come out every year. Most of the time, it's just to see what kind of reaction they're going to get, because we all know how wonky the media can be and ask questions. That's what that's about. And I know a lot of that comes off there as being very crude, but you're going to get asked a lot of dumb questions and put in a lot of high-pressure situations from media and fans that you're not going to know how to handle, and they just want to see how you're going to react to that. They really don't care what your answer is. They just want to see how you respond to it, if you respond to it in an effective manner or you just go off the deep end and start calling them out on the spot.
Derek, anything from you on that?
Yeah, a lot of times those questions are so far out there just to see you think on your feet, because not just the media, you're going to be out in public, fans are going to recognize you, you're going to have things thrown at you, or something's going to happen that's never happened before, and they want to see how you react to that. Is it in a positive manner? Is it in a negative manner? Also, there are some players who find some things out about themselves that they didn't know. Remember, this year, Ross Blaylock out of TCU found out he had, 27 unpaid parking tickets? He had no clue about.
All right. So let's start to look at the actual draft class. As always, Kevin Colbert pontificated at the draft. He spent a lot of time talking about Ben. He spent a lot of time talking about, Bud and the franchise tag, and he spent a lot of time talking about James Conner's season. Not a surprise that he got asked a lot of those types of questions. But one of the things that he did bring up is that in the view of the Steelers, this is an unusually strong class at outside linebacker and an unusually strong class at tackle. I know you guys and myself as well as others in the SEU also think this is a redonkulously deep wide receiver draft. Would you agree with their assessment? Do you think this is a unusually strong outside linebacker class and tackle class? Or do you not see that?
I'll let you go, Derek.
Okay. I definitely think it's a strong tackle class. It's a strong pass rusher class. I wouldn't necessarily say it's not one of the strongest. It's deep, though. There are a lot of pass rushers that I like in this class, all the way down to even a guy like Penny Willicks out of Michigan State. A lot of guys I like that can come in and help. Definitely not a strong tight end class, though, like we've been hearing.
I heard her sneaky good, though. I'm not really sure.
Yeah, sneakily not good.
No, I agree. I mean, I think the edge class is deep. I don't think it's spectacular. I think outside of Chase Young, there's really no can't-miss prospects. There's a lot of solid prospects that are going to come in and contribute year one and make a name for themselves. But, I don't think it's as bad as, the 2013 class or things like that. There were some really kind of wonky classes in the last 10 years. The 2017 class outside of TJ Watt wasn't really that strong there. And Myles Garrett, but whoever he is. Anyway, you have the tackle class, I think, is solid, which I think is going to work to the favor of the Steelers. And the receivers class, I mean, this has a chance to be one of the deepest receivers class we've ever seen. I mean, the fact that there's consistently 27 to 30 guys that are talked about with top three round grades at receiver is just absolutely incredible. And the thing about this receiver class, too, is there's so many guys that if you want a certain type of receiver, you're going to find them. Like if you want a big, tall, long, athletic one, you're going to find them. If you want a short, scat, you know, slot receiver, you're going to find them. And you're going to find them at any level of at the draft because there's going to be guys that are going to go day three that any other year would be going, you know, early day two, day one maybe. You know, so I think that's going to help teams that need a receiver and teams like the Steelers that do so well drafting in the middle of the draft at receivers, they're going to be finding another diamond in the rough. There's going to be guys that shouldn't be there. But are just because they're not getting much exposure to some of the top guys. But I agree with Colbert's evaluation. I think all three of those positions, you're going to be able to find guys that you're going to be able to contribute on your team and early on in their careers. And I don't think you're going to have to reach on many of them because I think there's going to be – I view this class as more of a top half heavy draft because of some of the top guys that are in this class that are kind of making a name for the overall prospect pool. But I agree with his assessment for the most part.
Gotcha. And now, so far, you know, what has been run? A lot of the offensive players, some D-line stuff has been done, but I don't think many D-backs have run or done much of anything. So, you know, those are the main positions I think still left to go over the next couple of days. But let's look at who you guys think are risers, fallers, so to speak. Who's helped their draft stock, and who's taken a step back? I know, you know, there's been a lot made of as you said, and we talked about this earlier that Zach Moss didn't run the most stellar of 40-yard times, but knowing that he had a hamstring tweak, knowing he's probably going to run it again at his pro day, and more than likely put up a better number, even guys like J.K. Dobbins who didn't run a 40, as far as I can tell. You know, chose not to participate. So, you know, and then you've got the other flip side of that where now I'm going to call it the DK Metcalf effect. A guy like Chase Claypool has put up really surprising numbers for a guy his size, much better than I think people anticipated. And now, of course, everybody is a draft Twitter is all a Twitter, so to speak, over him. Derek, we're going to start with you. Who do you think has really helped themselves so far in this particular combine?
You mentioned Chase Claypool. He's one. Denzel Mims is another one. He's a receiver now that drafted or Twitter is given first round consideration all of a sudden, which again, that goes back to the Kevin Colbert thing. Likely the boards are already set, but he really put on a show. Another one that kind of answered some questions for me is John Taylor out of Wisconsin. He ran, what was it, a 4.39 officially?
Yep.
That really answered some questions about his speed and his he doing a three-cone drill. I can't remember what he did in the three-cone drill, but John Taylor really answered some questions himself out of Wisconsin.
All right, Zach, what about you?
Yeah, going back to the whole Denzel Mims thing, he did well at the Senior Bowl. He did well at Baylor. He did well at everything in the process. He's a guy that, as draft Twitter likes to do, and I'm sorry that I'm coming off as salty about it, but like they, you know, he's a guy that's been around, and I guarantee you he's been in the eyes of NFL circles for a while, but now that the media is starting to get a catch for him and he put off these eye-popping numbers, you're going to see a guy like him, quote-unquote, rise up the board. But in reality, he probably is going to be a top 40 pick to begin with. He just, when you have a class that's as solid as this with some of the top guys like Jerry Jeudy and Henry Ruggs and, you know, T. Higgins and whatever, you know, you have all these guys that are getting all the attention all year. Guys like him fall through the cracks and he's always going to be there. But you know, it is what it is. But I agree with what Derek said. I think one guy that also kind of substantially helped out his stock was Cam Akers, running back out of Florida State, the Steelers met with. He didn't have a blazing time. He ran a 4.47 in the 40, but he's not a small back. He's a very compact, solidly built Steelers type of running back. So to see him run a 4.47 is huge. And he did well on the bench too. And since Derek likes that, you know, he did 20 reps. Not great, not bad by any means either. I'd be remiss if I didn't give my offensive line love to Tristan Wirfs. I mean, I you know, Iowa tackle. The guy, I don't even know how to describe his athletic profile after watching him. I mean, when you see an offensive lineman go through and he not only destroys his 40 time by running a 4.85 at 320 pounds, also has a 36.5-inch vertical at 320 pounds, has a 121-inch broad jump at 320 pounds, and a 4.68 20-yard shuttle at 320 pounds. I mean, my offensive lineman is showing clearly because I'm at a loss for words for that. I mean, I knew he was going to be a freak, but you don't see Iowa offensive lineman testing typically that well when it comes to the athletic stuff. You'll see him do well on the bench and things like that because their strength and conditioning program is one of the best in the country. But it was absolutely incredible to see him put up those numbers. And then Jefferson out of LSU, he's a big slot guy that I think a lot of people were kind of concerned about how he was going to run. And then he comes out there, does very well with most of his drills. I think that helped his stock out as well because I think he's a guy that could do it all. He comes from a national championship winning team. So I think it was very good to see him kind of go out there, do his thing, and have the success he had. I think those were kind of the two under-the-radar guys that – or three under-the-radar guys that did well to kind of help boost their stock to the point where you could see them potentially going earlier than some people might have expected early on.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned Cam Akers. I watched a lot of Florida State this year, and just watching the games, you kind of could get the feeling that he would put up some good numbers at the combine. So it doesn't come as much of a surprise to anyone who's watched a lot of Florida State. Also, I just looked at the John Taylor three cone, 7.01. So for a guy thought of more of a bruiser that carried the rock 900 plus times in college, 4.43940 and a 7.01 three cone drill definitely answered some questions about his athleticism.
Yeah, I'm both glad and annoyed that Zach pulled Tristan Wirfs because that was my guy. That was the guy that I thought, and it's for the very reasons you mentioned. At that weight, at that size, those numbers are absurd. They're ridiculous.
Can he play tight end?
Well, let's not start that conversation. But I mean, I think this solidifies him as a potentially even top 10 pick. You know, and when you add in what he has already shown in game tape, I think this is a guy that I was never going to be around, you know, in the second round for the Steelers to take unless a big bong video comes out or something. Notice that. And the other guy, which I mentioned, was Claypool. And the reason is, you know, unlike Zach Adonia, our resident wide receiver fanboy, I don't know whether you'll be upset that I called him a fanboy or not, but whatever. Zach Adonia, who falls in love with all the receivers. I rarely fall in love with receivers, but Chase Claypool's numbers made me stand up and take notice. And because I think there is a chance that he is on the board at around 49, even with those jumps, that's interesting to me. I liked what I saw out of Cam Akers. I did not watch any Florida State games because I don't care about Florida State. But I, you know, if they played Ohio State, I'd have watched it. But I will now probably go back and look at some of his highlights and film to see more about it, especially considering the fact that they did do a visit with him there. So those are the guys. Now let's flip the script, so to speak, and who's taken a hit in this combine thus far? And Zach, well, who did I start with last time? I started with Derek. Zach, we'll start with you this time. Who's underperformed, or whose stock may have taken a dip in your mind based on so far the results of the combine?
Sticking with the offensive lineman, I thought Trey Adams out of Washington, I thought he took a hard fall in my mind because he was a guy that I thought was going to be there pretty much in the top 40. I thought he was going to be guaranteed top 40 pick. I'm not going to put a whole lot of stock in his time, but he had some health concerns coming in. He ran a 5.6 in the 40, chose not to do the bench, or maybe health reasons didn't do the bench. I didn't hear which. But I wouldn't be surprised if he slid a little bit because of how kind of porous his testing was. His tape wasn't elite necessarily, but I thought it was good enough to put him as a top prospect because of his size. But I thought that was kind of a rough one. I also, going back to a guy that's been connected to the Steelers, Lloyd Cushenberry, I think he kind of had a questionable run. I thought his 5-2-1 wasn't too bad whenever he was running his 40, but obviously the hamstring injury is going to be a disappointment before you get the chance to do really any of the other drills. You know, Christian Berry is a guy that I think is a top interior lineman and otherwise average class. I don't think it's going to hurt his stock at all because of the fact that he's still going to be top lineman. Tweaking your hamstring in the 40 is not going to be enough to not draft you. But you'd hate to see a guy go and get hurt like that at any point in time. And honestly, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention some of the tight ends. I've been very hard on tight end class. I've been very openly hard on this tight end class. And I don't think the tight end class athletically did anything to pop out at me to say that I've been wrong in my evaluation when it comes to explosion. This was supposed to be a class laden with receiving options. And if you're receiving options, a guy that's around 4.8 down the field, I think I'll stick with Vance McDonald, you know, who runs a 4.7 or 4.68. There was no guy that really stood out. I know Adam Troutman's been a guy that's been getting a lot of attention as the potential riser, and a lot of people consider him to be the top tight end in this class. He did well in the new sled drill compared to some of the other guys, which doesn't surprise me because he is a high-effort run blocker. But his speed wasn't really anything to stand out. His agility wasn't anything really to stand out. And I still just view him as Adam Shaheem 2.0. I don't really view him as anything else beyond that. A small school tight end that's going to get attention and may or may not ever translate to the league. But I thought overall, with the exception of Alberto out of Mizzou, I didn't really think there was any tight end that did anything to really jump out the page, make me slam my fist on the table saying, athletically at least, this is a guy that we need to get. Because I think the tape was pretty consistent. Like I said, I think we've been reaching at straws with this tight end class because it is a weak class, trying to find the guys that we love because there's really no, you know, there's no Noah Fant, TJ Hawkinson, there's no Travis Kelce, there's no Evan Engram, there's no guy that you're pointing at saying this is the dude. So now we're just reaching at straws trying to find guys to fill those shoes in an otherwise weak class. And I think what we saw at the combine so far is pretty indicative of what you're going to get with this class.
Yeah, I have to jump in before I let Derek talk because Adam Troutman's going to become Mr. Ball to the face. The video clip of his initial
that was actually Mitchell Wilcox, unfortunately.
Oh, was it?
It was Wilcox of.
Never mind. Because it came out as it being Troutman, and if it wasn't, well, good for him. Because whoever it was, that was a bad look, man.
That was rough.
All right. So, Derek, what about you?
So, going back to the Brandon Hunt talking about interviews being one of the most important, and Zach, I think you're the one that first brought this to my attention. Jeffrey Okuda, not that he was a guy that we were going to get, probably going to be a top 10 pick. Probably not realistic option for us. Kind of came at an inner scout that asked a question about some of his penalties. Realistically, I mean, he said go put on the tape. Yeah, that's what you want to do. But at the same time, he could have come at that a better way. Some teams might be put off by that. Other than that, back to the tight end class. It hasn't been impressive. Nobody stood out, like Zach said. It's been kind of rough, and I think Tristan Wirfs might be the most athletic tight end, even though he's a tackle, in this class. I mean, it's
you know those Iowa tight ends, man.
Yeah, seriously, those Iowa tight ends. But Thad Moss is one. I don't know how I feel about a 6'1" tight end. You could use him like San Francisco uses Kyle Juszczyk, but at 6'1" at tight end, I'm iffy on that. So the tight end class as a whole, but Thad Moss and Adam Troutman specifically took hits for me.
Yeah. I mean the tight end position definitely was, again, because I listen to the professor often and I make my own judgments as well. But as badly as the Steeler Twitter base and fan base wants a great tight end to be sitting around at 49, there isn't a great tight end, in my view, in this group. There are some decent guys who can be, I think, who could potentially grow, but there's just nobody that makes you go, oh, yeah, that's the guy, and to think that they're going to be there at 49.
They feel like all niche, like role players.
Yep.
Yeah, this is the you know, it's just not a group. This isn't that kind of a draft. It's unfortunate that if you really think, and again, some of us don't really think that that is the a position of need, because we look at Vance McDonald and think, yeah, he had an off year, but how much of that was due to quarterback play versus due to Vance McDonald not having a good year? You know, maybe it's not that bad of a need. It's, as we've talked often, the Steelers' needs really are find good players to help restock the rooms that you have. And we've talked about maybe it's BPA all the way. Instead of JK all day, it's BPA all day. But, you know, we talked about, you know, the three-cone drill. I mean, Troutman did have the best three-cone drill amongst the tight ends at 6-7-8. But, you know, the rest kind of mediocre. You know, a lot of guys haven't run yet. So we'll have to wait and see. But, yeah, I just that was the position group, and all of them had at some point some level of performance where you just went, eh. And as we said, Alex O maybe got his stock to rise some with the 40 and what he was able to do, but then he didn't do the bench, and I can't remember if it was injury related or not. I think it was, but you know, so maybe any gains he gets come away with you know are negated by not necessarily being able to do some other stuff. So if those are our risers and fallers, as we look at this, you know, the Steelers don't have a first round draft pick. To be quite honest, I don't see a scenario where they end up getting one. Not a realistic one. When I do my mock draft insanities, which of course are the whole point of is to make up some baloney, to get, you know, the most ridiculous draft you can get. But I, you know, you could maybe do a trade to get back up into the first round, but the Steelers, I just don't see it happening. You know, they feel comfortable that their first round pick this year was Minkah Fitzpatrick. I feel comfortable that their first round pick this year was Minkah Fitzpatrick. And I think they'll probably stay put, with where they're at. So as you look at what has transpired at the combine, thus far, and you look at that first pick in the second round, what are players that you think reasonably, based on who they've talked to as far as you know, based on what you've seen, should be or could be targets of the Steelers at 49? And Derek, we'll start with you.
I know we've been talking in the back rooms a lot over the last couple months about JK, if JK's there at 49. Realistically, I would not have pegged a running back as an option until I saw how many they met with at this combine. So I definitely think one of the running backs or one of the receivers may be in play. And as we all know, I've been pushing offensive line for some time now. I think offensive line is where it's most important to start retooling. My opinion, of course, I'm not Kevin Colbert. He's much smarter than I am. But I'm thinking offense at 49, definitely Claypool if he's available. Mims if he's available is an option. Or one of the running backs like Cam Akers or if someone else falls. I also really like A.J. Dillon out of Boston College. Not at 49, but another running back that I believe we showed some interest in that I like.
All right, Zach, what do you think?
I think Kevin Colbert historically has been pretty kind of close to the vest, but he kind of drops hints as to where they're leaning. And historically, you can also look at the combine meetings, the pro day dinners, and the pre-draft visits. Those are typically the three things you can kind of go and point in the direction. And right now, they're clearly doing their homework with running backs, which I don't know. I've had the point. I don't know the need to draft the running back early, but they clearly have an interest as they're preparing likely for life beyond James Conner, and Jalen Samuels isn't really the every down back. And only have Snell going in his second year, so I'm not surprised they're doing their homework there. Receiver, even if they still had Antonio Brown, Juju Smith-Schuster, and Martavis Bryant, I think they would still draft the receiver in this class because of the fact that it's just such a deep class. You have to take somebody, and there's so many guys that are going to be there, and they've shown very clear interest in Chase Claypool beyond just the combine. They met with them early on in the offseason. He's been connected with them frequently with interviews and whatnot. I think they're going to continue to do their homework. And I wouldn't be surprised at Notre Dame's pro day if you end up seeing Kevin Colbert and Mike Tomlin and Hilliard, the new receivers coach, all there to go and meet with him. You end up finding out they have a pre-draft dinner or a pro day dinner. So I think that's position. I think edge is also the very clear position there. My choice would be interior offensive line. I think they're still going to look in that way. But I also wouldn't be surprised if they end up going another direction. I just think with the talent, if you're truly looking at going BPA in this draft, realistically, it's going to end up being a receiver. It's going to end up being an edge. It's going to end up being a running back. There's going to be somebody there that's going to be the top player on your board, and all three of those guys are going to be able to help you out. I think when you look at the guys they've met with so far, it's pretty indicative of that. I know Cam Akers seems like a legitimate choice because I think he's a top five back who should be there at 49. I think he kind of helped his stock out. I think he fits well with what the Steelers try to do. I think Zach Moss is going to still go earlier than expected. I still think his 40 time is going to get way overblown by draft Twitter. I think his tape shows a guy who is a top five, top six back in this class as well. But you see other receivers there. You see like Jalen Reagor. You see guys like Chase Claypool. They're all guys that they've met with, and I think they're going to continue meeting with, and it makes sense that they're meeting with them, and it makes sense what the Steelers do from an offensive standpoint, getting those kind of do-it-all guys. The one that interested me that they met with was Jonathan Taylor, and I don't know if that's just due diligence because they've shown a penchant for going after Wisconsin guys, and they have a really, really strong relationship with Wisconsin. I wouldn't mind seeing Jonathan Taylor here. Like I said before, I just worry about his tread. You have all those touches in college, and he's managed to stay healthy. I don't trust that to be a long-term thing. I really think he's a four-year, five-year guy who you ultimately have to move on from because of the fact the injuries start piling up. And then there's edge guys they've met with as well, but I really don't think edge is going to be the move if they were able to retain Bud Dupree either on a franchise tag or just manage to re-sign him. I think a tight end is also an option there, but I don't think they're going to be sold on a lot of tight ends. I really think the only one that kind of makes sense for them is Albert O. I've been preaching him for a couple months now. He fits what they do athletically. He fits what they do from an offensive perspective. He's athletic enough to get the job done, and I think he's an effective enough blocker to kind of learn and grow when you look at the tight end class as a whole. But I think that's the route they're going to go through. I think Kevin Colbert had kind of alluded to that when he was talking about the positional strengths in the combine this year.
Yeah, I'm gonna stay on my running back horse to a little bit since I've been on that that trend. I'm not surprised that they met with that many running backs at all because in my mind, if you look, even though you know we all want to stay optimistic, we all want to say okay, you know Connor previously had a good year, but even those. The years that he was able to play, he seemed to be, I don't want to say injury prone, but he got bit a lot by injuries, and part of that is the style of running that he does, and just you know what he does. But the fact that he was not didn't have the most important ability of availability most of last season, on and off was a problem, and you guys know. I don't dislike Benny Snell, but I don't like him as much as everybody else does. And I don't know whether he can grow into being that bell cow kind of back. And regardless of how many teams have successfully created a pool of running backs, the Steelers generally have been a team where they want a bell cow back, a guy who plays the majority of the snaps. And you know, Connor had been that guy. And it's tough when he's not that guy because Jalen Samuels is definitely not that guy.
No.
You know, so it won't surprise me. You know, my Ohio State bias still says I want JK because I like JK and I think that he can be that kind of back. But I'm not adverse to to the Zach Moss. After you brought him up, I went back and looked, and I'm like, okay, I can live with that. I can be happy with that. I'm gonna now look at Cam Akers, but the fact that they're I'm sorry, you know, I'm with you on. I like Jonathan Taylor. I think he's been a good back, but you know what? The Buckeyes shut him down for basically every year, and the amount of carries bothers me a lot.
Fumble issues as well with Jonathan Taylor.
So fumbles is an issue. Yes, that's right. Fumbles are an issue as well. I don't think he will be around, and I don't know that they will honestly consider him there. They gotta be cognizant of that amount of touches. The wear and tear on anybody's body, regardless of what the medicals would show, regardless of what his 40 time is, regardless of the fact that he was able to avoid injury, that's just wearing, and it is what it is. There's only so much tread on a running back that it can exist. So it makes me nervous. But, you know, if look, I'll trust them if they think that's the guy. But the fact that they've met with so many running backs does make you believe. Now, that I'm going to put a note of caution here because I know we've all agreed with this, and Zach, you've been preaching this heavily, and I agree with you completely. It's not so much the numbers that you see at the combine. It's not even so much the visits at the combine, especially the informals. It's as we move down the road here in this process, who are they meeting with at pro days? Who are they taking dinners with? You know, who are they spending more time with? Those things are a lot more indicative of where they may go than some of these other things, informal visits or who we or our draft Twitter especially projects to be there. You know, if another somebody comes out and tells me they're going to pick Jalen Hurts or another quarterback, I'm like, I'm sorry, you guys, just stop. Stop with that crap. It drives me nuts. So I still think that there is I agree with what you guys have been saying. I think it's an offensive position that comes in the second round. And I'm inclined to still think it's going to be a running back, although I would be very ecstatic if it was Lloyd Cushberry. I'd be happy if it was Chase Claypool. I want a playmaker at that pick, somebody who's going to come in and help the offense to be a little more dynamic than they were. And while that may not be Chase Claypool, that may not be Lloyd Cushenberry. I would be still happy because I do see the offensive line as aging, and it needs some influx of talent. You talked about Cushberry, Zach, getting dinged in the process because of the hamstring. I feel bad for him, but I'm not going to cry if he falls into the third round and they get him with a compensatory pick. You know, I'm going to be like, yay, bad hamstring. but I don't actually think that'll happen. I'm sure that, you know, he'll heal up and when LSU's pro day comes along, he'll perform. But if that doesn't happen and the scouts have to worry about it and teams have to project, who knows, what could happen. I still think there's a reason they're meeting with running backs. I think that there is concern that James Conner cannot necessarily be the bell cow they want him to be. And how are you going to address that? You cannot have the same kind of production from the running back position going into next season that you got this year. I think that has to be improved. So as far as anybody else, do you see anybody else? I mean, because here's the people that we know for sure, and there's others. I mean, you mentioned Jalen Reagor. Do you think that that he's going to be there?
No.
In any shot? No, I don't either. So, I mean, it's – I think that – this is my own personal philosophy. I think that Mike Tomlin likes to meet with guys just because he likes to meet with guys sometimes at the combine. I think he just wants to see. He's a football guy, and he wants to see guys he thinks are good football players. Plus, there is a bit of gamesmanship that goes along with this. Some of these guys could be around when another team in the AFC North drafts, and he wants to get a sense of those guys. So I think a lot of times the Steelers will meet with guys they know absolutely there's no way they're going to be able to draft. They're not going to come in anywhere near them, but they could end up as an opposing player on an opposing team within their division. I think he probably is the kind of coach that would want to take advantage of getting as much information on those guys as he can. They met with, Albert O, which I think could make sense. Cam Akers, Josh Uche, Curtis Weaver. So there's a couple edge kind of guys or linebacker guys. What did you think of that particular visit? Because Uche is more of a inside linebacker, right? Not an edge guy.
He's a chess piece, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah,
it's Yeah, to that end real quick before you say it, I think a big part of what Tomlin does with this as well is if you look historically speaking, a lot of these guys, they don't draft, but they end up, unless they hit free agency, they bring them in. Steven Nelson's the most recent one that comes to mind. The Steelers learned a ton and waited for him to free agent. And obviously, he signed the second he had the opportunity to. And we see guys like Deion Kane and Kareth White. Kareth White came in for a pre-draft visit last year, and Deion Kane, the Steelers showed a lot of interest in the year before. So these are guys that they also keep tabs on as well, so they start developing those relationships early on, waiting for them to come there. But I think Ishii is more of a niche player. I think he's more of a role player. I think he can rush off the edge. His height and play style is kind of reminiscent to a poor man's Devin Bush. I think he could play really anywhere you want him to, but it's going to require a lot of creativity to find a spot for him to go into. And I think the Steelers now have the pieces in play with guys like Minkah Fitzpatrick and on the outside and an elite front seven. I think they have the ability to kind of move him around and have success to kind of put him in a position to succeed. I just don't see the fit, but I mean, he's a solid player. I'm sure they know a lot about him from their time scouting Michigan last year when they were, going over and over and over again with Devin Bush, Zach Gentry. I think they have the historical aspect of going after Michigan guys. So I wouldn't be necessarily surprised if he's really on their radar and if they feel that there's a place for them to put him. I don't necessarily hate the pick. I just also don't necessarily see it as a massive need for where he would be. I don't view him as an everyday edge rusher, if that makes sense. Like I don't think he's T.J. Watt. I don't think he's Bud Dupree. But I think he's an exciting piece because he is a very explosive player. He's a very good tackler, and I think he's a decent cover guy as well. So I think you can take advantage of that, and he is on their radar. I don't know if he'll be there at 49, but if he is, I really think that he kind of has the opportunity to be a hybrid type of athlete they could use on the back end. I mean, it'd be nice to see him kind of transition to more of a traditional linebacker role. I just don't know that's going to happen. I think that's going to kind of dictate how good he becomes in the NFL. And I think a lot of that's going to be on the backs of the team that drafts him. And hopefully if that is the Steelers, they can take advantage of what he brings to the table.
Gotcha.
I think a lot of it too, Michigan or Tomlin likes the region and not just Michigan University, Michigan State, Western Michigan with a core of four, Central Michigan with AB. He likes the region of Michigan. Hmm. Also, we should mention at some point too, he's met with two guys that come to mind that the position shocks me, Cam Dantzler and Jalen Johnson, cornerback.
Yep.
I did not think at all, with the signing of Hayden and Nelson and drafting Justin Lane last year, I didn't think cornerback would be a position they're looking at, but they've met with two of the top guys. I mean, Dantzler and Johnson are both in my top 10, so that's another thing to look at there is cornerback. What's the interest there? Or is it a smokescreen?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I think that they have to do legitimate, groundwork because, even though they did draft Justin Lane, Hayden is aging, so at some point they're going to need to inject fresh talent in that room as well.
You might be losing Hilton.
Yeah, you might lose. You could be losing Mike Hilton in this offseason. So there's. I understand them looking there. Yeah, I think it's unlikely that they go there. Plus, those two guys, as I said, I'm not sure either one is going to be there at 49, but maybe they would. You never know. Corners always seem to go in bunches, right? Somebody picks one and then the run starts. And that sometimes is true of a lot of groups, especially if you have need. And cornerback is a top need in a lot of teams throughout. That's why the pay scale is where it is for corners in the league. And you end up paying top dollar to get good corners because there's not enough of them. Same as edge rushers, same as a lot of positions. So I think, if you're looking at this, and everybody realized we still got a couple days in the combine to go, but you're looking at this, and it's a reach to look at the third round because we don't know when the compensatory pick will hit or how good it will be. But from what you guys have seen, is there a legitimate target you think they could look at in the third round to try and make some hay there? And Zach, you can go first.
I think there's going to be some running backs that are there. I think there's going to be some receivers that are there. And it's hard to dictate where either of those are going to go because running backs, you don't, like, traditionally speaking, when I pulled the numbers, you see two to three running backs. I'm not going to say two and a half. Two to three running backs are typically selected in the top 50 every year. And then typically from that point to 100, there's a run on them because that's kind of the sweet spot recently in the third and fourth round of where we see the productive backs in the league that you don't have to spend a lot of investment on that still produce are going to go. So I think there's going to be a run on running backs at that point. If they don't go with one at 49, I could very easily see that third round pick being one. I think the tight end, if they do end up going tight end, which I'm still not sold on them drafting a tight end. I'm not saying I don't think they should. I don't know if they're going to. I wouldn't be surprised if a guy like Alberto is the pick there. I don't think his stock is going to skyrocket a whole lot as much as his athletic traits would indicate that, because there are still some inconsistencies on his tape and his film that I think are going to push him down a little bit. So yeah, I think he could be a third round target. But I really think if they go offensive line or edge with the 49th pick, I almost guarantee you the next pick's a wide receiver or running back. If they're going to go that route, I don't think I'm still on the train that I don't think running backs are that big of a need in the grand scheme of right now. But I wouldn't be surprised if they went in the third round. I just think that it's such a deep receiver class, and there's so many running backs that you can plug into your team to be successful. I think they'd be remiss to not add a guy at that point in time. I really think that'd be the location to do it if you miss out on one of the top guys in 49.
Gotcha. Derek, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, a lot of it depends on what does happen at 49. Obviously, if they grab one of the running backs at 49, you're looking at maybe build the trenches, offensive line, nose tackle as well. If someone falls that they like, they feel could replace Hargrave. I don't see necessarily a nose tackle that early, though. That's a position that's less than 40% of snaps played. I don't know if I would be comfortable taking before the fourth round. But again, I'm not Kevin Colbert. So nose, trenches, offensive line, nose tackle. Depending on what happens with Bud, we could see an edge rusher go there as well. Edge rushers for the third round. They met with Curtis Weaver out of Boise State. He could definitely be one of the guys that they take with that compensation pick in the third round, depending on where it's at.
Gotcha. Yeah, I fall in line. Look, if they don't do running back in the second, I think that they very likely could do it in the third. If they don't do a receiver in the second, they could snap a receiver up in the third. I think it stays on the offensive side of the ball. I think that there's a good chance the top three picks are all offensive picks in this draft for the Steelers, just because when you look at what happened last season, that was the weakness. And yes, we all anticipate, you know, getting Ben back will help that, but I think that there's reason to think they need to inject some youth and some new talent on that side of the ball. As I've said, and I will continue to repeatedly say, and I will call out as silliness anytime I see it, they're not drafting a quarterback. But
you mean they're not drafting Justin Herbert in the fourth round?
No, they're not drafting Justin Herbert in the fourth round because and because he's not going to be there. that's just silly. I don't know. Sometimes that's why I do mock draft insanity, because it's insane. Some of the takes are just clearly insane. All right. So I think that's going to wrap it up for us this time around on the podcast. Hopefully we gave you some insight into the combine, what to look for, what to look at, maybe some players to pay attention to now. And maybe early next week, after everything is said and done, we'll give you a full recap with this same group of individuals. And Joe will be back with us next week sometime into our regular schedule. Sorry, this took a little longer to get up there on the interwebs. So, Zach, any final words from you? Again, thanks for jumping on. Anything you want to leave the world with, so to speak?
I just enjoy the draft process. I mean, it's a fun time to see the next wave of NFL guys come in and, you know, understand the fact that the Steelers' needs are not going to be really determined until we see how free agency pans out. So don't go jumping off of bridges just because your favorite guy isn't the pick in April, you know?
Yep. All right. Derek, since this is your first time on the pod, let everybody know how to find you, where to see you out there in the interwebs, since we all know how to find Zach and probably me. And again, thank you for joining on. We appreciate the insights and any final thoughts.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. Next time, I promise I won't be getting over the flu and coughing hat through most of the podcast. You can find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is doverly34. That's pretty much my handle across the board for everything: Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Don't add me on Instagram, though, because I'm never on it. I just love the draft process as well. It's something I've always watched and been ingrained in. It also makes it hard for me to hate any NFL player because I invest so much into watching these guys through the draft process. I want them all to do well. So I just look forward to the next time I'm on, guys. Thank you.
Absolutely. And for everybody out there, remember to like, subscribe, and comment. Let us know your thoughts. Let us know if there's anything you'd like us to cover. We've got a lot of off-season left before we get to, you know, mini camps, rookie mini camps, OTAs, and then finally, training camp. But it will go by fast. And if there's things you want us to discuss, let us know, and we will. For me, I think I find it easy to hate players as soon as they wear purple. and now a lot of times that poop brown. I can hate them just as well. So I don't care that much. I like the draft as well. I enjoy the process. I like learning, especially from guys like you guys, and forming my own opinions. But yeah, I don't invest in that. You become a Raven, I hate you. You become a Cowboy, I hate you. Zeke's dead to me. He's been dead to me since he left Ohio State. So
what I'm hearing is that you like the Patriots.
No, I hate the Patriots. I don't even mention them. Anybody that goes to the Patriots is doubly dead to me. Just bury them. So, all right, for everybody else, that's going to wrap it up. We will talk to you next time. And until then, as I like to say, it's chaos out there, so be kind.
We would like to thank you for listening and remind our listeners to follow us on social media and our website, www.steelcityunderground.com.